I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A federal judge sides with prosecutors that there is enough evidence to charge a 30-year-old woman from North Philadelphia with trying to help ISIS. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, her attorney says the charge is vague and that she's protected by the First Amendment.
Under the name Young Lioness on Twitter, Kiana Thomas sent public and private messages to a self-described jihadist in Minnesota and to a known extremist overseas. That was enough, prosecutors say, to charge her with providing material support to ISIS. Courts have said that that means she was intangibly helping out extremists. Terrorism expert Seamus Hugh says more than 70 others around the country have been charged after similar social media activity.
I think there's a realization both in Department of Justice and the FBI they need to be a bit more forward-leaning when it comes to cases. So in the past, they've let things develop a little bit more. But after recent homegrown attacks and things like that, they're simply moving the bar a little bit farther.
Hugh says the case hinged on who she was talking to more than what she was saying.
If they're talking to a known or suspected terrorist, a known recruiter online, that raises your level of concern more than if you're just, tweeting out into the cyberspace and hoping someone listens to you. It really connections kind of raise you up a little bit more.
The FBI is now looking at more than 900 people with possible links to ISIS in the U.S.
That means 900 people have social media accounts and 900 people you got to follow on a regular basis. That becomes essentially where you're going to triage the system and determine who's the real threat and who's not.
Thomas's trial on the material support charge is scheduled for June. If convicted, she faces a maximum 15 years in prison. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
For 150 years, New Jersey manufactured chemicals and products that became familiar fixtures in homes. Charcoal, lighter fluid, plastic, silk. It's the job of the state's Department of Environmental Protection to ensure that that industrial past is not affecting the health of residents today. But an investigation by WNYC finds most of the state's poorest residents are living near contamination, and there's no plan in place to clean up those sites. WHYY's Sarah Gonzalez reports as part of our series entitled Dirty Little Secrets.
90% of New Jerseyans live within 1 mile of a contaminated site. This is according to an analysis by WNYC's Data News team. Most of those sites are in some stage of the process to clean up the contamination. That can take years. But an investigation by WNYC has found 1,400 of the state's 14,000 known contaminated sites don't have a cleanup plan. Many have sat orphaned and polluted for years. And those sites are disproportionately found in low-income communities. Months ago, the State Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, told WNYC those sites were mostly abandoned properties, old gas stations, and former dry cleaners where the state couldn't find the owners. But WNYC went through the list and knocked on doors. And we found open, functioning businesses, a state prison, hospitals, police stations and fire stations, churches, schools, all without any plan to clean up the contamination. The DEP says they've tried to get those sites to comply. They've reached out by phone and by email 69,000 times, they said. I spoke with Philip Scott and Richard Lopez, who work for the city of Newark. Their job is to keep track of contaminated public buildings.
So that would be buildings such as City Hall, courthouse, police stations, fire stations, things like that.
Okay, great. So that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. I tell them about two police stations in Newark that are on the list, but they had no idea there were any public buildings in the city that still needed to be cleaned up.
No.
Really?
No.
not that I could think of.
No, that we're aware of.
So what is the process? Like, who is supposed to make you aware of this?
That's a good question. I would assume that DEP would be required to make us aware of this.
The DEP, the state agency, is no longer responsible for overseeing most of the state's contaminated sites. The state legislature outsourced the work to private contractors in 2009 after kids in South Jersey were exposed to dangerously high levels of mercury at their daycare center. The DEP didn't know it had opened in an old thermometer factory. Private contractors now investigate contaminated sites and determine how they get cleaned up, not the DEP. The DEP is no longer involved unless a site becomes an immediate health risk. Ana Baptista, who grew up here in the Ironbound, says that at best, that makes for patchwork oversight of public health and safety.
Instead of putting more funding and resources into the state to handle these cases and oversee them, they completely shifted it to a privatized system. Here we are years later. It doesn't seem much more efficient or any better. And it's also left behind the issue of accountability, cases that fall in the cracks.
Malcolm X Shabazz High School and Maple Avenue Elementary in Newark slipped through the cracks. Both public schools are run by the state. They made the DEP's list because of soil contamination from old oil tanks. They were given specific deadlines to hire a cleanup contractor. One was in 2012, the other was in 2014. WNYC checked and found neither school had begun to deal with their contamination until a couple weeks ago, days after we asked about it. Mark Peterson with the DEP is not concerned. He said these sites that are still waiting for a cleanup plan are low risks.
I want to assure you that as best as we can, we're identifying what are the sites, what's known to be there, and is there potential impact.
If there is a potential for health risks, Peterson says the DEP steps in.
If I don't have a party willing to do the work and there's a potential human exposure, we have public funds to do that, and I do not hesitate.
But they don't always step in time. Some of the low-risk sites have become immediate threats. That's what happened to Modesto Vieira. Meet Modesto. He's a singer.
I do Frank Sinatra, New York, New York, of course.
He moved to Newark's Ironbound neighborhood from Portugal in the 1970s and is a proud U.S. citizen.
I never went to the army, but I was registered. I was registered.
We're outside of Modesto's dream home.
Can you hear that?
And this sucking noise he's trying to get me to hear?
It's like psss.
That's an exhaust pipe that starts under his garage and runs along the side of his house. It's sucking up toxic fumes from the soil and shooting the fumes into the air. No one told Modesto his house was built on the site of a former lighter fluid factory. In fact, homes were never supposed to be built there.
It was like a gassy smell, and we couldn't figure out what it was.
In 2013, the state became aware of it and found residents on Modesto's entire block had been breathing in toxic, cancer-causing fumes for 12 years.
Ever since they dug the holes in here, the air has gotten better, and I don't feel the headache as much.
The DP installed the air filters, but it's a temporary fix. The contamination is still there, and it's spreading. It moved a block over, and now the state is testing the block next to that, where Kathleen Gray Rodriguez lives.
When I got that notice, it scared me.
She got a letter from the DEP in October that there may be toxic fumes in her home.
In my home that I'm in every day, breathing.
According to an analysis by WNYC, 3 out of 4 residents who live below the poverty line in New Jersey are living within a mile of a site that has yet to start the cleanup process. It's 75% of the state's black population and 80% of the state's Hispanic population, compared to 40% of white residents.
We pay taxes. Okay, some more than others, but the government, they have to do the right thing. I don't care how costly it is.
Cleaning up contaminated sites is expensive. And everyone I spoke with, developers, owners of contaminated sites, the DEP, they all say sites don't usually get cleaned up until someone wants to buy the property. Mark Mariello used to run the DEP before Governor Chris Christie's administration. And he agrees with the advocates who say the new privatized cleanup process leaves behind low-income communities where the land isn't considered valuable.
You look at Camden, you look at Newark, you look at Trenton and Patterson. There's a significant relationship between communities of color and communities of poverty and the level of contamination. This is a really big deal.
The DEP stands by their system. They say private contractors are making progress on a long list of contaminated sites. And they say they will step back in if there's an immediate health risk. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
WNYC's data news team built an online tool for New Jersey residents to find contaminated sites, and you can check that out at wnyc.org. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf must decide what to do with a last-ditch spending bill sent to him without the increase in public school aid that he wanted. House Speaker Mike Terzai formally signed the bill this morning and sent it to the Democratic governor's desk. Wolf's office says no decision is likely before Monday. A defense attorney in the George Washington Bridge lane closing case is assailing the government over documents he says have yet to be turned over. The filing by Michael Critchley accuses the U.S. Attorney's Office of failing to compel New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's office to produce relevant documents. The U.S. Attorney's Office declined comment. The Vatican has defrocked a Pittsburgh-area Roman Catholic priest who was removed from public ministry in 2009 after accusations of child sex abuse. 67-year-old David Germeghau was indicted on child pornography charges in 2013. He was sentenced last year and is now serving a 3-year sentence at a federal prison hospital in Massachusetts. Overcast, 68 degrees at 617. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Cloudy this evening. Still the chance of scattered showers overnight. Low 56 degrees. For Christmas Day, it starts off partly sunny, then clouding up with a chance of showers. Friday's high, 68 degrees. Still ahead.
We were just starting out with people getting on the phone saying, I can't believe you exist. I can't believe how intelligent you are. And I can't believe how much you knew and the fact you'd spend that much time with me. A heck of a foundation to build a brand on.
We'll look at how one local company is making its mark through customer service when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Tinsel, that ever-present holiday decoration, is not going anywhere.
I think it has tapped into a sense of nostalgia where people today, with all the bells and the whistles and everything is so glittery, we're still looking for the traditions.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the business behind Tinsel's sustained shimmer, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
I listen to Bullseye because it always includes real talk with interesting artists who I might never have heard of otherwise. Each interview includes real honesty from these artists that I don't hear anywhere else.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank and with the band Mission of Burma on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This holiday season, you may have spent a bit of time speaking with customer service. The bar for helpful customer relations is set pretty low, but one South Philadelphia startup is building its reputation in part on quick and courteous support. From the Innovations Desk, WHYY's Todd Bookman took an inside look at the Revzilla call center.
The latest results from something called the National Customer Rage Survey show that more than 60% of people were dissatisfied with a recent customer service interaction. Just the fact that there's something called the Customer Rage Survey, yeah, that sums it up. But at the Revzilla call center, it's hard to find such discord.
I like shorties, especially on a Grom. Get shorties.
Yeah, I actually have a cargo net. I put it on. I put that on top of the US-30.
Oh, are you talking about the E349?
I hear you. I definitely hear you. Let me see. We've got a grand total of $60.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. All right, have a great day.
Revzilla is an e-commerce company that specializes in motorcycle gear and equipment. Its call center is in the brightly lit back corner of the company's headquarters, and it looks more Silicon Valley startup than cubicle farm. Everyone sits at open desks. The furniture is modern and clear of clutter. Patrick Roscoe runs the department.
The design of our facility here is, again, it's very non-traditional. We've gotten away from the historically small 4x4 cubes that you'd see in any other contact center environment.
Plus, like all good startups, there's a gong to celebrate each time an employee gets a positive online review. When the company launched in 2007, the three co-founders, including CEO Anthony Bucci, answered all the calls and complaints themselves, and realized pretty quickly how they could set the company apart.
We were just starting out with people getting on the phone saying, I can't believe you exist, I can't believe how intelligent you are, and I can't believe how much you knew and the fact you'd spend that much time with me. a heck of a foundation to build a brand on.
Today, Revzilla has close to 200 employees, nearly $100 million in annual sales, and 50 staff members just in customer service. They're called the Gear Geeks, and though it's an entry-level gig, they're pretty well compensated. Bucci says starting salary, benefits, and bonuses are about 20 to 30% higher than the industry average.
I'm investing that dollar in making sure that every person that's potentially at the point of purchase, their expectations are beaten by talking to somebody that they wouldn't expect to talk to.
Revzilla's good salary and pipeline for promotion keeps turnover low and morale high for the Gear Geeks, even during the holiday rush when phones are ringing nonstop.
Right now it's beginning to wane, but yeah, it's kind of nuts. It's all hands on deck for those guys. It's been for probably the last 6 weeks, and gals.
To get one of these jobs, you need more than phone skills and endless patience. Patrick Roscoe says you've got to know the merchandise inside and out, and that means knowing bikes.
Every single Gear Geek here that supports our customer center here rides a motorcycle. They know it. They are passionate about it. They are following forums. They are researching all the new products. They geek out on everything new within the industry.
The staff also gets to try out everything. Revzilla has a room full of gear that staff can use on weekend rides. It's part of the culture here that separates this call center from some other local companies that don't sport sterling reputations.
Selling cable service all day long, I don't know how passionate people truly are about supporting cable box needs.
Heather Jarjissian is 6 months into the job. She's got a sticky note attached to her screen that reads, "Be annoyingly thorough." But she doesn't come across as annoying.
Everything about it, the people are awesome, the customers are awesome. Yeah, it's just an excellent place to be. Yeah, way better than any job I've ever had.
Life for the Gear Geeks calms back down in mid-January, after all the holiday returns and exchanges are figured out. Then in the spring, when bikers come out of hibernation, the phones will start ringing again. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Okay, so no one's answering. Well, can't you just let it ring a little?
By many measures, there's ample evidence of shifting gender roles in America regarding food. Circling back to examine the many ways food and femininity come together in women's lives in 2015 is the endeavor of a new scholarly book entitled Food and Femininity. Joining me is co-author Kate Kerens, Assistant Professor of Childhood Studies at Rutgers University Camden. Kate, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, by invoking that name in the title, Food and Femininity, if you were to take it all the way back to that first wave, your book cites the quote from Betty Friedan in The Feminist Mystique, 1963, where she critiqued the idea of the happy housewife. Obviously, we're invoking more contemporary standards of feminism.
It's an interesting context. I think today, you know, many would remark that when we turn on food TV, we're just as likely to see a man cooking. Many of us probably have friends who are men who identify as foodies and who enjoy cooking. But we find even in this context where food isn't so explicitly linked to femininity, the vast majority of what we call food work, so the everyday work of planning, meals, shopping, cooking, cleaning up, continues to be performed primarily by women.
Though that has certainly evolved too since the mid-60s. So much food is now purchased outside and consumed outside of the kitchen or home.
Absolutely. But we also are in a context where food is seen as intensely important in our social, cultural, and political lives. So invitations to buy local, shop at your farmer's market, teach your children where their food comes from, try out new home-cooked recipes. And we find that even, as you say, that we're past the sort of 1950s figure of the housewife, food still remains intensely connected to femininity. For instance, pressures surrounding what's sometimes referred to as ethical consumption. So thinking about the social and environmental implications of your food shopping practices, that because those are put on individual consumers, those individual consumers often tend to be women.
The book also examines economic implications, whether one has the means to A, afford, and B, have access to what we now consider healthy foods.
Absolutely. We can see gender and class working together so that working class and poor women are under a particular amount of pressure. And in our research, we found that that was often experienced emotionally. So a sense of guilt, possibly shame, and frustration that there was a particular kind of gold standard of food shopping and also mothering that was out of reach for the low-income consumer.
So, Kate, certainly during this holiday season, there's ample evidence of tensions at times between the male-female gender role in preparing and hosting.
Absolutely. I think holiday meals are a time where we can see the kinds of intense emotions related to food playing out. So preparing a meal that expresses cultural traditions and brings family and friends together around the table can be a source of reward and an opportunity for women to gain a sense of satisfaction through their food work. But it also is an immense amount of work and pressure and can generate feelings of stress. So, you know, it might be an opportunity for folks to reflect on in their own families, in their own gatherings, who is doing the majority of this food work, not simply the very visible work of standing at the stovetop, but the kind of invisible labor of planning the meals, of preparing shopping lists, going and doing that shopping, also considering everyone's different taste preferences, making sure that folks are having a good time, right? There's a lot of emotional work that goes into holiday meals. And that work tends to be gendered. So the holiday season might be an opportunity to reflect upon the ways in which the division of labor around food within your own home.
Standing at that stovetop is just the very tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely.
Kate, thanks so much for shedding light on this very interesting and complex issue.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kate Cairns is Assistant Professor of Childhood Studies at Rutgers University Camden. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week for Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Tomorrow evening, we'll devote our entire show to a story we first broadcast in September. A look at one Philadelphia elementary school's attempt at a complete turnaround. Thanks for joining us, and have a great holiday weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. We're getting in the holiday spirit with Gordon Lightfoot and Ronnie Hawkins. Next time on Cue, the musical veterans will drop by the studio to chat about their new collaboration on the song Christmas Must Be Tonight. That's coming up on Cue from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The holiday gift that keeps on giving is a fund at the Philadelphia Foundation. You can support the arts, protect natural areas, promote health, provide scholarships, and help the needy, all while receiving tax benefits. The Foundation makes it easy to make a difference now and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
On our Christmas Eve edition of The World, a chance meeting in a World War II Japanese internment camp. Two boys who would later become leaders in Washington, Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta.
He's one of the dearest friends I have.
Equally so from my perspective.
They've been talking about injustice and freedom for more than 70 years. Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta on The World.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.